Tonight, what I'm going to talk about, I'm going to do two things. The first part is about four transitions that I see in society. And because I come from a society that's a long way from here, I would then like to have a short, very short discussion around your tables where you say, is any of this real to us? And then if it is, I'd like to have a little bit of feedback so that I get to learn something as well. So don't think I'm coming here to tell you how things are. I am on a journey always, looking at the culture, and the culture is always shifting. So we are always needing to learn. As I said before, I worked for many years in Eastern Europe doing cultural research. I'm trying to understand how communism was affecting the minds of people who lived under absolute authority. And then how suddenly this enormous freedom that they had did or didn't work out in their life. And then I moved back to England, and the difficulty for me was that England had changed massively whilst I was gone. And I'm therefore in England saying, what is this country I've come back to? And the things I'm going to tell you are things that I believe are true about England today. And if you don't have them here now, you might have them if you just go unthinkingly into the future. We have a lot of confusion about identity. Many people don't know what it means to be English anymore. And actually, I think it's a rather healthy thing because we're having to start to think through who we are and what we really want. But there's also lots of issues around sexual identity, and a lot of people who come to La Brie come with an inner emptiness, an inner loneliness that they are living with. And we're trying to understand what is this and how has that shifted over the years. And something is definitely shifting. So I've been thinking about it, and this that you're going to hear is really the sum of some of that thinking. And partly what I'm going to give you is a transition. This is the first one. If you lived in Britain 200 years ago, you'd have lived in a village where you probably wouldn't have moved. You wouldn't have moved out of it very much. You'd have stayed there. My aunt, who 50 years ago came to London, had never been more than 10 miles outside her village, and that's just 50 years ago. She lived in Cornwall, in the very south west of the country. And she had a strong identity. If I asked you, what do you first think of when I say, what is your identity made up of? She would have said, we. She wouldn't have said, I. But if I sit around a table at La Brie now and ask that question, all the kids from America, all the young people from England and from Western Europe always say, I. Some of the people from Russia, some of the people from other places say we. And that is a transition that's happened over time, and a significant one, because we comes from the need to survive. And my aunt grew up on a farm, and her family before her, and their family before them, and they would have had a very strong need for help just to get through life. I think in the turn of the 19th to the 20th century, 40% of people worked on farms in Britain. And now 1.6% of people work on farms in Britain. And we produce many times more food than we did back then. And how do we do that? We do it with machinery. So we don't need the same sort of number of people that we would have needed. So, if you grow up in a village, you know the people who are there. You have a very strong sense of belonging. I lived for a while in a small village in Germany. And when we were living there, The carpenter, the village carpenter, had a lovely workshop, came and he'd made a little stool for my then three-year-old son, my now 33-year-old son, and he'd made a little stool for him. It was very kind, and it was a welcome gift. And we got to know one another, became friends, and he said to me one day, he said, you know, my great-grandfather's name was carved in the desk in which I sat at school. And I thought, wow, that is a deep sense of belonging, a deep sense of rootedness. I can't remember one person I went to school with. Not one person. Partly because I lived in Malta, we moved away, we're not connected. But even so, not one person. And so people saw themselves as communal. They believed in God. Therefore, they believed that history had meaning and the future had meaning. And they also knew to whom they had to be loyal. Because if you weren't loyal, you wouldn't get the help. And so even if they didn't like the people they were living with, they had to be at least on a relationship where they could manage to get together and to function together. So they had to moderate their behavior. And they couldn't always say all everything they wanted to. And they had to be somewhat respectful, at least enough to have the relationship. So I don't want to idealize any of these. There are difficulties with all three. But just to help you become aware of that transition that I think is happening to some degree all over the world. Then we had the First World War. And the First World War was in Europe had a massive effect on our psyche. So we started to abandon our belief in God for a number of reasons, philosophical reasons, and then the war was one of the things that really disturbed people's belief. Even though for many years you wouldn't have noticed much change. And all of this, the ideas that I'm talking about and the changes I'm talking about take a long time to happen. And they happen in different stages, in different parts of the society. So whenever you say, this was happening, I could also say some of the other things were happening too. So it's the idea of transition over time. We would look, if you went into the big cities of Europe, you'd see the castle on the hill, and you'd see just opposite it, you'd see the cathedral. So when the tourists now go, they look, wow, isn't that fantastic? Look at that lovely church and all the rest of it. But when the European comes there, they look at the church and they look at the cathedral and they say, this is how we used to be ruled and that is how we used to believe. And then they go on their secular, very, very secular way. We had great houses. I don't know if some of you have ever watched the film Downton Abbey or the series. Some of you, probably not by the looking at it. But if you have, we had the Lord of the Manor. He was there, and he had a responsibility to look after all the people under him. And there would be a lot of people under him. And many, many families. But that is now flattened out. That hierarchy has completely disappeared. It's interesting that it has been replaced by a new hierarchy, a new elite. But people don't like to talk about that. Everybody's got a vote. But the power structures have completely shifted, just as they did under communism. And in each of these contexts, we have to ask ourselves, what does it mean to be human? And how do I know things? And in that I-we, the what does it mean to be human, I was in a community. And what does it mean to believe? I always had a very strong institutional authority. There was the Lord of the Manor, I needed him, whatever he believed I tended to go along with. Whatever the church believed I tended to go along with, because I'm in an institutional structure. And I don't really know too much about it myself, but they know and I can just trust them with it. Then the second change, which happened after the First World War into the Second World War, after the Second World War to some degree, we started to lose our belief in the transcendent. We started to move to cities and to places of work. We start industrialized places of work. And so there's a great urbanization. So in moving, we lost our sense of rootedness. We didn't know anyone anymore. We started to need each other, sure, but less. We needed each other socially. We needed each other for kids, and the family structure was more or less intact. But we were moving on, and it became an I-you. You was still there as an object to my subject, but things were beginning to get very tentative. Because God didn't exist, we had to create our own meaning, and to some degree, our identity. And then after the war, they began to say, what we need is a social support structure run by the state, the welfare state, that did education, did health, and did pensions, and just looked after you if you were unemployed. And it sounded like a great idea. And to many ways, it is a great idea. But I no longer need you at all. So I don't need to be nice to you. And if you're not nice, I can leave and I can go and get my rights from the state. The trouble is, the state is anonymous. And I have to fill in forms and there's no mercy. And now with the computer, there's even less mercy because if the computer says no, there's no one you can talk to change your... If the computer says no, it's no. And maybe some of you have been in that situation. So what was the network before of support was the extended family. And the extended family, to some degree, functions now. It's interesting that since we've had problems with the banks, the extended family has come in to support bank loans so that the young people can get housing. But that's a relatively new return, which is an interesting thing because the state simply cannot provide and all that's demanded of it. And we have gone from being 22% of the GDP by the state to now we're around 50% of the GDP is run by the state. But someone has to make the money before you spend it. And that's part of the problem with that cycle that we're now confronting. But there's no God, there's no heaven in this. And people are transitioning in their thinking. And again, slowly, things change. And yet, you have the old symbols. So when I got married, I got married in Finland. That's one country I didn't mention. My wife is from Finland. I go there every year, have done for the last 37 years, because that's how long I've been married. But when I got married in Finland, I had to go to the British Embassy. And I had to have the banns read. And I don't have any idea about how you get married here, but in England, under the very old system, you used to go to the church in your village, and the vicar would write your name in a book, and he'd put a sign on the door which had to be there for 3 Sundays. And it said, if anyone knows any reason why this person shouldn't get married, because they're married to someone else in another village, for example, then you must say so. Well, that's great in the village where everybody knows you, but then you go to Finland where nobody knows you and you go to the embassy and they say, well, take the Bible in your right hand, okay, and there's just me and the man in the consular office in the office, hold it over your head, say after me, I know of no just cause, blah, 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 why you shouldn't get married. And then pay me £25. So I paid the man the £25. They put my name and my wife's future wife's name up on the thing, and they said, the banns have now been read. And 3 weeks later, I was able to get married. But nobody knows me in Finland. It was a totally meaningless thing. And so the link between the old traditions and the new gets split apart. And the younger people say, what are we doing that for? And the older people sort of say, well, you must do that because wasn't there a reason? Can't we remember why we used to do that? And slowly these things start to drift apart. And so the experience then is increased of being alone. And now, because I have a vote, and because I've educated, the number of people being educated was going up all the time, the number of people going to university was going up, I was expected to think. And so I knew by my own personal authority, and I had to think and make decisions, take responsibility for myself. And as that kept going, we started to divide where we work from where we live, and where we play from where we worship, if you worshipped at all, which was getting less and less and less. And in that same period, we had a lot of membership. The membership of the Conservative Party was 1.3 million, and the Labour Party, those are the two big parties in Britain, was about the same. And the church was had many millions of people in it. Now the membership of the Conservative Party is 130,000. The membership of the Labour Party is a couple of hundred thousand. It went up recently because they had an election and got a few members. And it'll go down again because nobody commits to anything. And what's happening now is all the public communal spaces are starting to close up, with the possible exception of many of the churches, interestingly. And the church is about the only place, apart from the pub in Britain, where you can go and have a multi-generational meeting. And the pubs are closing at about 20 per week. So I'm not exactly sure the statistic, but it's something in that order. And so people don't go out, they stay at home. They stay at home alone. And it's gone from being an I-you society to an I-I society. And so we are now becoming, and this is more true of young people than the older people, a hyper-individual society where we are unknown. We work in one place, we play in another place, or we do our other things in another, we shop in another place. So I would go now to my local village where I live has no shop. If I want to go to a shop, I have to go several villages away to get a big shop. And I can go in there, and I can get my products, and I can click them on a little thing they give me, and I can go to the cash desk, and I don't have to speak to anyone. Where in the old days, you had the village shop, and when you went in, you got all the gossip about everybody everywhere, and you knew who you were. So it was a question of being known and now being anonymous, being unknown. Loss of the communal space, closing of the pubs, but being replaced by screens. And the screens people sit in front of tell you who you are. Whereas you used to sit in the pub and maybe play games, and you'd watch people and they'd watch you, and you'd have some banter and some fun, and you'd learn about yourself and about other people. Now you sit in front of a screen, and the screen tells you who you are. And you have a terrific sense of not having any history. And anyway, your whole attitude to history is changing because you're no longer a Christian. You are a naturalist. And that starts randomly, by chance, from nothing, and moves to nothing because you die and that's the end of it. And so the only real meaningful experience you have is now. And so the screen reflects back who I am, and I get a relentless barrage of propaganda about what I'm supposed to think. And because I'm in a communal society, we'll come back to that, consumer society, it has an impact on my mind, and we'll come back to that in a second. But the subject-object relationship has somewhat disappeared. Here's the subject. There's objects out there, but I don't know them, and they don't know me. And there's a tenuous link with history. And we seek the transcendent, but we seek it in our experience. And the stronger the experience, the more we believe it to be true and real. And so what we've moved from is an authority structure that told us where we are, to reason, to a sense of I must find this experience of this reality through my experience. And that is the feeling, the affective, emotive feeling. So every impulse that I have within me tells me who I am and what my identity is, because nobody else is doing that. And that is a change in what it means to be human. So here's a couple of statistics. In 1955, the year I was born, 4% of the population lived on its own. Now, 30% of the population lives on its own. 70% of the buildings built in the last 10 years have been for single-dwelling housing. The room sizes are getting smaller, partly because land's so expensive, and we don't have much of it, but also because we don't need it so much. I heard a statistic, which I haven't been able to check out, where only 30% of families now have a table around which they can eat, but only 8% of families actually use those on a weekly basis. Because what do? You come home, you get your stuff, and everybody's got a television in their room, and everyone wants to watch something different anyway, and so you just go there and entertain yourself. And in the bigger cities, it's much higher than 40%. And then single-parent families, 26% of all families with dependent children, all families with dependent children are single-headed families, and 92% of those are headed by women. So the men are disappearing from the society, from the engagement in the society, which has massive effects on how young people get feedback about who they are, how they get affirmation, whether they are actually wanted in the world or not. And that creates a lot of the loneliness which we see, which is not just, I'm on my own, I need some company, but even in company, I feel I simply don't know who I am. Then the second transition. This is a shift in our consciousness at the intuitive level. So I am a... earlier on, I would have been vaguely Christian. I would have gone to church because the Lord of the Manor would have required it. I might have believed it. I might have been active. But it would have affected my morals. It would have affected my behavior. That would have been the standard. Then the shift to a sort of, not overtly atheistic, but sort of ignorant level of belief. And a mental model of life which said basically everything is random. We're in a naturalist society. What you see is all there is. There's nothing transcendent. And when you die, that's the end of it. So that would have been the mental ascent. But at the gut level, I would have been operating vaguely from this kind of Christian view that I'm a human being, not an animal, that there is some sort of future. And it's interesting. I actually have occasionally, as part of my research, I go and visit funerals and cemeteries. And what has happened is that as God has been replaced, it's been replaced with incredible banality and sentimentality. So people talk about look in the stars up there, there's your mother looking down on you. And as long as you can get through a couple of days with not having to believe any of that's really true, you can manage. You manage the painful moment. And there is a fundamental shift in the consciousness of people. So what has been up here is moving down here. So now they are actually operating out of the idea that the future is meaningless, that there's nothing much to hope for, and the past is just a set of random coincidences. And that has a huge effect on how you perceive yourself as a human being. And so what happens is that the people concentrate on the now. And this was fascinating to me under communism in Eastern Europe. You're supposed to be building the future for your family and so on. And all these communists were becoming bigger and bigger and getting land for themselves in the nicest places and building real mansions. And you're saying, but that's not communism. But they were saying, yeah, but we need something for ourselves now. It's a great idea to sacrifice for your kids, but yeah, what about me? And that's what happened. A new elite emerged, which just had all of the power and took for itself what was available. And because the other people didn't have the power, they didn't have access, lived in small concrete homes, which were better than nothing, but in comparison, they were not much. And so no meaningful past and no future, the importance of now, and then the immediate. I do know one thing. I know how I feel. I know what I'm experiencing. I don't know what the future is going to hold. I don't know what the past is going to hold, but I do know how I feel. And so a very strong sense of being in the moment without any other senses to shape that moment, no historical precedent to lean on because I no longer trust them. And so the sexual revolution that we're going through now in Britain comes out of that. I know sex is good, it feels pleasurable. I'm not really bothered about the person who I'm going to have it with as long as I have a good experience. And I can change. I'm not building connections because there is no future. And that shift in consciousness is really what I'm talking about, because we operate out of our assumptions about reality. And many of our assumptions about reality are never named. We never say, I believe this, and therefore I'm going to do that. We just operate out of here. And it has some quite catastrophic consequences. So God is dead, there's no absolute morality, there's no meaning, there is only power and how I feel. Very, very different from the old Christian belief that power was moderated by love where possible and law where necessary. And certainly in Russia, where I have lived and worked and done business, a lawless, a truly lawless society is an incredibly cruel place to live. And that law, a legal society, is an amazingly strong gift. So that's the second movement. The third movement was consumerism. As soon as communism fell, 4 years later, everybody, McDonald's showed up. And I went into the first McDonald's that was there in Bratislava, where I was living, and they had clean toilets. And there weren't clean toilets before. And that's one of the great benefits. Suddenly everybody had clean toilets because McDonald's was showing them what it should look like. And the food wasn't that great, but at least you knew it was exactly the same as everywhere else. And what you were buying was consistency. And very interesting transitions in people's expectations. So in the communism, you went in and you bought a pair of shoes and the sole fell off. And you went back and you said, look, this is broken. I've only had it for 2 months. And they would say, well, that's tough luck. Well, when you went back, when Kmart opened their first store in Bratislava, you went in with your flapping shoe and they said, oh, let me change that for you for a new one. Wow, you thought, this is really great. This works. And everyone felt good for a long time because suddenly you had stuff. And under communism, you really didn't. It simply didn't work to generate the kind of capital growth necessary to give people products. But slowly that transition means that I no longer create my culture. I buy it. I no longer sit with my friends and make music, which is what they used to do. I just buy a CD and put it on and listen at home, alone. And I upgrade for something better, and I get used to this perpetual upgrading. And in fact, what we've created is a machine for generating feelings of envy. Well, he's got one of those, and I don't have one, and I want one. And an incredible amount of envy and competitive spirit, because how can I get that? And those things are good things. They're nice things. Here I am with all this sort of kit and stuff. It's comfortable to use it. And so, but what is too much? How much is too much? And when the only validation I have is how much I have, you simply can't get enough, because our need for validation is infinite. I believe it's infinite because we're made in the image of an infinite God who can stand opposite us and validate us infinitely. But you can't go to a shopping mall and get infinite anything. You very quickly run out. And just about the shopping mall, I did a lot of research on shopping malls because I wanted to know what they were doing and how they were affecting the mind. And I discovered that the first shopping mall was developed by a man called Victor Grün. Victor Grün was an Austrian Jew who moved to America in 1938 to avoid the Holocaust. And he wanted to create in America, which he thought was a very sort of not very cultural place, and coming from Vienna, which is a very cultural place, he wanted to create a beautiful place where you could shop like in Vienna, with lovely trees and musicians and lovely coffee shops and so on. And he started to create this, but somebody else discovered that if you could get someone in there and you could make them turn around a few times as they're walking, they started to lose their sense of orientation. And so they developed what they called the Grün moment. And that was the moment in the shopping mall where you went in with a purpose and suddenly you forgot why you were there. And you felt a little bit anxious. And what did you do when you were anxious? Well, you started to buy things because that is an adrenaline kick that suppresses the anxiety. And so all sorts of things you can learn. Those shopping malls are very highly designed to stimulate within you all kinds of emotional reactions. And so the consumer society is by no means neutral. And it stimulates the senses. And so in our society, we had this great flattening, this great anonymity, and our senses being our hungers for significance, for value, for validation, being stimulated and then being satisfied by a pair of shoes with a little swish on it or something else. Or a DVD, or on a day of desperation, a big box of something in it, electronic. And so you had this hyper-stimulation of the senses, but under-stimulation of the thoughts processes, of the critical faculties. Because the last thing they want you to think of is, do I really need this? They want you to think of everything but that. And so you go in and you are flooded by sensory stimulus. Pictures, changing things, flashing lights, sounds. And you go into a supermarket or a shopping mall and just analyze it for yourself. See the kind of colors, the things that are happening, the advertising. I go into there and I see a picture of David Beckham. Do you know who David Beckham is, footballer? In his underwear with his six-pack, and I think, I am hopelessly lost. My boat has sailed. I will never be able to be like that. And what do I do with that emotion, that sense of loss, that sense of something dying? I go and buy something. So the envy machine, the competitive spirit, the validation through accumulation. And then with this always on, always plugged in society, we are left with raw emotion. And that is what informs us about what things really are. That is how we know in the modern society. And that is an extremely dangerous position to be in. Someone is always selling something. And especially in a time when education is really mere training. There was a time when education was the development of your critical faculties so that you could discern what was going on. But more and more education is training you to do a job, to fill in a hole in the system. And the ability to focus on objects outside of yourself and analyze them and think about them in many people is being reduced and reduced. And we just turn on boxes and screens and so on to get sensory stimulus. And we're not that bothered really what's in it. So those are four areas that I have identified. I want to go on to talk about feeling and emotion. But before I do, I'd like, because you've been listening to me for a long time, I'd like you to simply answer the question around your tables. Does any of this reflect your reality? And if so, how? Is that all right? Just in the table where you're sitting, just say, just talk about that question. And well, I'll ask some of you in a minute for some feedback. Okay, let's draw our thoughts to a conclusion. So what do you think? Give me some feedback. Help me to learn something. Where would this be the same? Where would this differ? Maybe something from a few of the tables, just to, so we can learn from each other. More and more stimulus, yeah. And very fast stimulus and news traveling very, very quickly, isn't it? Yeah. I'm a news addict, I confess. Google News, first port of call. Economist, second port of call. Anyone else? How about this table here? One of you would like to say what you thought? It's a powerful emotion, isn't it? It's a powerful thing to suddenly realize you're slipping behind. And suddenly the anxiety raises up. And,
I think another thing is that as the time goes by, society defines what we have. So we don't define what we want to achieve in life or who it is we want to be. Rather, society has norms about you become acceptable when you're certain things. Start living your life wanting to achieve those things and forgetting about what it is that you really want. So humans won't admit, but 50% of us are not where you are. We're not where we are because we want to be there, but because society thinks it's the best place to be.
Yeah, it's interesting. So we are being named by the environment we're living in. Described by the environment. So our ideas of freedom are actually only half true at the best, and maybe not even that, because someone else is describing us and describing our reality. How about this table? Lots of very intelligent people there. I mean, intelligent people everywhere. I'm not, but you... What is amazing to me is how hard that is to resist. Incredibly hard for me personally to resist it. I cannot help having a sense of being undervalued if I don't have the latest bit of kit. And I have to just really remember who I am and where what my longing, my biggest longings and desires are. Like what? I'm having a difficulty. Survive, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank you. It's very important. What is it? Where has the glue gone that used to hold us together? Well, to some degree, the glue was need, and now we need each other less. And that's not a great reason to be together, but it is a better reason than nothing. Would you like to?
Just a question for you. Because I'm wondering, all of us are real, but what you have just described is true for our society and culture. However, I'm just thinking, you know, in your research, have you ever researched on how mature people, sitting with mature people, taking that, you know, because it must come as a shock, you know, some of the individualism that is there, the tendencies that we are now pursuing, and all these things too. Guys like my friends here, where family was very important.
Yeah. It is massively shocking. I was with some people this morning. In a university, in a Bible college, and I told them that on Facebook you can now have 74 different genders, and they didn't know about it, and it was rather shocking for them to suddenly realize that the world around them sees itself in completely different categories than they do. And I think when I speak in churches, the people are completely unaware. They think life is going on, and everybody thinks like they do. So we just had a big discussion about gay marriage in Britain, and everyone woke up and said, well, the world is different than I thought it was. And that debate was completely lost in the churches. They didn't realize how much society had moved on. And many of the older people are shocked by that kind of transition. And we're suddenly left unsure of our foundations. And then the church says, am I right or are they right? Because we've never had to face that before. And suddenly the foundation for believing is really, really tested. I'm a Christian. I have no problems with grounding my faith in very good reasons for why I believe. But it was a lot of work. For me, it was a lot of work, and it still is a lot of work, trying to understand the environment I'm in and the challenges it brings to me as someone who does believe that there is a transcendent, infinitely good being at the back of the universe. Well, let's go on a little bit, because otherwise you will... wait a minute, where am I? Oh, yeah, sentiment, there we go. I'd like to take a little bit of time to break down some of the categories we use and think about them with you. When I think of feeling, lots of the people who come to us talk about their feelings. They want to feel more. And I say, well, what is a feeling? Anyone have any kind of quick definitions? Well, let me give you one, just so we don't lose too much time. A feeling is a response to an external or internal stimulus. So I pick up a glass of warm water, and it's warm, and I feel it. I stand by a radiator, and it's warm, and I feel it. I go out in the sun, it's a little chilly, I feel it. It doesn't do anything, it's neither good nor bad, it's just there. I stand under the shower, and I feel wet. That's a normal thing. It's a feeling. Some feelings are painful. Some feelings are pleasurable. I prefer the pleasurable ones to the painful ones. And some of them can be quite addictive. We like to repeat pleasant feelings. And given the option, we usually prefer the pleasure over the pain. And yet, there are some feelings that might actually give us both at the same time. Here's a feeling. Is this just a feeling? Or is it more than a feeling? It's more than a feeling. How is it more than a feeling? How does it feel to be in love? It is more than a feeling, and we will come back to that in a minute. But how does it feel to be in love? Anyone want to be bold enough to give a couple of adjectives?
Wonderful.
Wonderful. It feels wonderful to be in love. Let me give you a few helps here. Wonderful is one of them. Joyful, happy, distracted, aroused, excited, attracted. The center of someone's attention. Oh, wonderful. Center of someone's attention. My wife, I said, what does it feel? What is love? I said to her. And she said, love is kisses. And I was really irritated. I wanted a deep, profound discussion. I said, love is kisses. And I asked her a couple of years later, what is love? I said. She said, love is kisses. And I asked her a couple of years later, we've been married 37 years. It's a long conversation. I said, love is kisses, she said. And a couple of years ago, I slowly got it. When I love her properly, I get more kisses. And I thought, she's a really clever lady. What is an emotion? Well, you feel an emotion, so it must be a feeling. Or you should feel it. If you don't, there may be something wrong, because you can hide from them. But what is that? What is an emotion? You should act on it. You don't always act on it. It's in the word, isn't it? Motion. Movement. A movement is always toward or away from something. I have an emotion. Opposite me in the field that is opposite my lovely green field. It's in England. I live in the countryside in a village. There's a field with horses in the back. There's a field with cows in the front. In the field with cows, the cows are beautiful cows. These are gorgeous red-brown cows with an absolutely stunning color, and I do really mean this. And I love to look at them. So I get in the field. There's cows and there's bulls, actually, in the field. And these are gorgeous specimens, big, beefy. They're milk. They're not milk cows, they're meat cows. And so I'm walking across the field admiring the cows. And I see one cow drop its head. It's a bull. And it starts to do this with its legs. And I see it starting to snort. And I have a vague memory of something somewhere. And I'm thinking, well, that's a lovely cow. It's a gorgeous bull, actually. And I'm feeling good about the cow, the bull, and myself and life. And suddenly he starts to trot. And I think in my mind, oh, bull. Deep out of the recesses of my memory, I remember bull and red. And I look at my red jacket and I think, because I am now anxious. Fear has kicked in. And I have to think, what's fear supposed to do? Well, it's supposed to motivate me to analyze the situation and see if there's danger. And if there is danger, take responsible, often courageous action to do something. And that is usually with the bull running away and jumping over a high hedge and getting out of the way. So the emotion is supposed to move me towards something. And or away from something in this case. And anger would be the same. Love is the same. It's supposed to be something that drives me to something else, to a proper, responsible action. Anger is one of those that is very difficult, because we get into trouble when we're too angry, when we're too explosive. But not all anger is explosive. Some anger goes internally. And so when we say anger, usually what we mean is explosion. But what we should see is that anger on its own is actually quite neutral. It's a driving force to help me correct a wrong. And it should require courageous action, because sometimes it can be quite intimidating to have to go and take that action. So that's what an emotion is. An emotion is a feeling that should result in some kind of action that brings resolution to whatever stimulated the emotion. This may involve a moral choice and courage. I'm going to leave that. But here is something that is very interesting, because this is part of where the change is happening. Sentimentality is self-referential emotion. It's the turning of the feelings back on themselves. Feeling about yourself, feeling. This means that people in the grip of sentimentality who think they are in love may actually not so much be in love with another person as in love with their own emotions about that. You think they are in love may actually not so much love another person as the emotions about that other person. Their love may be largely for and what the other person does to and for them. Do you get the idea? The emotion is not moving me towards the other person to know them. It's moving me towards me. And love in our modern society is an interesting thing, because we often equate it with sexuality. Sentimental emotions do not result in responsible action. This makes sense if feelings are self-referential, they're about me and not the outside world. Sentimental emotions distract and anesthetize us from what might be appropriate responses, especially if those responses are costly or inconvenient, like loving someone. And so in our mind, in the popular consciousness, through all the screens that we watch, through all the films we watch, there's a connection between love and sexuality. But sex, love is not the only reason we are attracted to people. And here are some very dangerous ones, which is why often the confusion about the relationship between sex and love is very dangerous, because we are all needy people, and we use sex as a way to get satisfaction or to repress painful things. Sentimentality is that particular human vice which consists in directing your emotions towards your emotions so as to be the subject of a story told by yourself. What looks like feeling for another really has me as the object. So the subject has become the object. Instead of me having a real encounter with a real other person, I am now merely encountering myself. This is something I ask people in Le Brie when we sit around the table. When I say I love you, who am I talking about and what do I mean? Because the young people who come to us obviously want relationships. So I love you. Why do I love you? Well, I love you because you are lovely. Ah, you arouse in me feelings that I associate with love. All the ones we just talked about, yeah? Yeah, of course you do. Well, what happens when you're not lovely? That's a lot of work to stay lovely all the time. You know, it really is. And if someone says to you, I love you, you better say, are you talking about you or are you talking about me? Because I'm not going to be lovely all the time. I will promise you that. But I love you because I'm a lover. That means I will love you regardless of how you are. And you are lovely, so that's going to be all right for me. But in those days when you're not, I will still love you. That is my word of honor. Because I am committing my subject to your object. That's a very different world. I commit myself to your best good regardless of how you make me feel. I'm committing myself to my word. And the question is, am I a liar? Am I a truth teller? What are my values? Now you really need to get to know me. Because you need to know whether I'm just stringing you along. So if I'm left on my own, as a young baby from the outside world, actually I would die. I need somebody else to bring me up to maturity. But when little children are born, they are the center of the universe. There is nothing else but me. A part of growing up is realizing, coming to maturity, is hearing mother's voice, then hearing father's voice, differentiating, I am not you, you are a different object to me that I must now get to know. And there's a ritual and a process by which we do that, which largely we have lost. So when people come to us, they say, how do I do that? And you know what we do now on Monday nights? We play games. We have no screens, we have no Wi-Fi, we play games together. And people learn, oh, that's interesting how they do that, and oh, he didn't react very well to that, and well, that was fun, and they start to see each other from the outside. So the subject can now learn to live with the object and learn who the object actually is. So what I say has to have content. What is it like? What is it like to be a father at 3:30 in the morning when your baby has just vomited in the bed, your wife has the flu, and she can't get up, and you have a business meeting at 7:30 that you have to be at, or you're going to be fired? And you get up at 3:30, and how do you feel at 3:30? Let me tell you, you feel tired, you feel anxious, you feel angry, you feel frustrated. And what do? You get up and you look after the baby. And that's what love feels like at 3:30 in the morning. It feels angry, tired, frustrated, and all that other stuff. And it does what is right. But that, if you live by the positive emotions, you might as well go home now. How things, healthy interaction between subjects and objects. I am a subject, the other person is an object, I can get to know them as a human being. They are not me, they are different than me. And they are going to make me feel all kinds of different things. And the joy of getting to know a person means I have to negotiate the issue of trust. Do I trust you? Do you trust you? Can you trust me? Do I respect you? Do I honor you? Do I hold you in dignity as you are as a human being? Can we grow to maturity together? And so it is within the relationship with me and my wife that I have actually had to confront things in myself that need maturity. And it wasn't there, and I had to say, I need to help to grow up. I need to bear her burdens as my own and allow her to bear mine. So my identity is also partly defined, not exclusively, by what you tell me as a human being, because I see the world from inside my head. I don't see the impact I have on you. And you need to tell me what that is for me to have a full picture of who I am. But in this other system, this new system, the subject uses the object to feel good. But it's not interested in the object for its own sake. And so when the object no longer does it, we walk away and we don't grow up. And because subjective definitions are infinitely malleable, they're infinitely changeable, to be defined by impulse and by feeling means that there is no stability within me or within the other. And so I'm at the mercy of every external source of stimulus that comes along. And the advertisers spent billions of dollars figuring out how to just make you have impulses. I could tell you lots of stories about that. But the political people do too. The propaganda of our world does the same thing. We're going through an election at the moment in England. Actually, we're going through a referendum on the 23rd of June about whether we should stay in the EU or whether we should leave. And everybody on all the sides is trying to make me feel anxious about whichever decision I make. And it's a very dangerous thing. I need to have critical faculties, and I need to have truth-telling and information. So in becoming infinitely variable, we become nothing more than a clothes rack on which other people put their wares. And that's not, in any definition, freedom. And we talk by one another rather than meeting each other face to face as human beings. We just talk by one another in endless noise. I'm going to leave that one. The Bible says it's not good for man to be alone. And the reason it says it is because, well, one of the reasons it says it is because every subject does need an object in order to know who they are and in order to grow up. And the need for an external view of myself, as I said before, to complete the picture of who I am. And that requires trust. And the need for truth-telling, so I know that I live in a moral universe without any reference to God or anything else. Because if I don't get that, I know from my experience and the experience of many other people that I am somehow dislocated in myself. And so I want to encourage you to think of revelation as a way of knowing. Interpersonal revelation. You and I can know one another only when there is an environment of trust and the ability and the willingness to open ourselves up to one another and reveal what's there. I can make a quick survey of you all and I can look at you and I can know a little bit, but I cannot know the substance unless you invite me in, unless there's an exchange, unless there's a trust which makes that workable. But my world is infinitely richer when that happens, and your world is infinitely richer when that happens too. That is human knowing at a very profound level. And in order to have that, we need to know what the basis of trust is. And one of the questions I use is this: who is this object? Even if I didn't exist, who is this person? Because I'm not talking about objectifying someone. I'm talking about who is the substance. And every one of you must have the right to say, this is who I am. And I must not allow my imagination to write the script from my experience on who you are before you've had the chance to say. And so it's a discipline for me, discipline for you, to say, I do not know. Tell me. I do not know who you are. Let us walk together and trust one another and see. And be careful with that trust. Don't give it lightly, because we're not trustworthy. We're not trustworthy, and we have to know the foundation for our trust. Or any other object, not just a person. As I've talked to people who've started to get into this way of doing some things, they begin to see objects and become fascinated by them. And suddenly they're no longer bored, looking for stimulation. They're generating their own stimulation about the world around them. They're curious. And that is a wonderful journey of discovery. So learning to discover and relate to other objects, not as they are and not as I want them or need them to be. And then real love is only possible when the real me meets the real you. And that's something very worthwhile. Now, until then, all you have is sentimentality. And so we gift each other the question, what is your name? There's a very interesting story in the Bible, and I'll close with that, and then we can have some questions and answers. It's a story about Jesus going along. He's in a boat. There's a storm. He calms the storm. He gets out of the boat, and a man comes to him who's naked. Not a pretty sight, but nevertheless, that's what it is. He's got chains on his hands, and he's running. And he's running towards Jesus. And the Bible tells you the context, that he's someone that they've put out in the tombs. He's living amongst the dead because he's so sick. Demon-possessed, it says. And as he's running towards the man, Jesus says to him, "What's your name?" Now, I don't know about you, but what I would be saying is, "Where's the boat?" I would be going in the other direction. But Jesus, totally secure, says, "What is your name?" And the man says, "Legion, for we are many." But Legion wasn't his name. Legion was the demon's name. His name was George. I know the original. Well, it's not George. I don't know what it was. But his name was something else. His name had been given to him by his mother. And then it says he was sitting in his right mind. The people came and found him sitting in his right mind. So he became himself when he came to Jesus. And Jesus simply asked him the name, "What is your name?" Well, your name is not a label. Your name is the summary form of all the attributes that make you up as a human being. All the bits of you that are so wonderful and so delightful and validate your being simply by the fact that you exist. And you don't have to accumulate anything. You have infinite value because you're made in the image of an infinite God who wants you to be there. In the beginning, God creates the heavens and the earth. He didn't have to. He chose to share existence with someone outside of himself. And so the gift I give you and you give me is, who are you? What are those attributes that you offer to the world? And I make a commitment to be a loving human being to a standard which isn't found in you, because you're not lovely, neither am I. And God doesn't love me because I'm lovely. He loves me because he's a lover. Anyway, that's my little talk bit, and now we can have some questions and answers and see where it goes. Okay? So, who would like to have a question or discussion? It doesn't have to all come through me. You have a lot of wisdom too, so... That's an excellent question, because I also believe that as a Christian I should live in the now. Partly because every experience I ever will have in my life I have in the present moment. And I need to be present to the I am, God himself, who is in the now with me. But the modern person only lives in the now. They have no reference to their history and they have no hope. No solid hope of a future which actually determines how they behave today. And that's the difference. I live in a sequence of a purposeful existence which God has called me into. And I'm a free person. He expects me to grow up and make mature decisions and take responsibility. And I do that now. And that affects how my future is. As a Christian, I believe in the kingdom of heaven. Not as some place I go to when I die, but something I live into here. And when I pray the Lord's Prayer, I pray, "Your kingdom come." So then the obvious question is, what's that kingdom like? Because I ought to start living it now. If I don't want it now, then I probably won't want it then. And it does take some time to actually work out what is that. and that's another talk, but it's an important piece of where am I going, and how does that affect how I treat you today? Yeah, that's a good question. How do you recognize whether you're just being sentimental or whether somebody else is? Well, it's obviously a lot easier to recognize someone else is because you can sometimes feel it. You feel a kind of lack of the critical, I want to be careful here because it could be misunderstood, the critical faculties. Human life is made up of wonderful beauty and awful depravity, and often in the same moment. We human beings like to make a nice little pile of good, and we think there's a nice little pile of evil, but it's not like that. In me, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, a Russian who was in prison for a long time, said, "The line between good and evil runs through every human heart, and who can cut out a part of his own heart?" And that's our problem. But it's also helpful for us, because if I'm with a person who never sees anything negative, then they're not living with a totality of reality. And if I'm never seeing anything negative, if everything's just positive and wonderful, then I'm very possibly in one type of sentimentality. And I should say that love is one type of sentimentality. Anger, other emotions, fear, or all of these can be self-referential in the sense that they make me feel good about myself or feel alive. You know, sometimes the people who come into me, I think what we're really saying is, I hurt, therefore I am. And so it's not just about love, this sentimentality, this self-referential nature. But life is made up of the good and the evil. And critical faculties should help me to discern, is this person dealing in reality? Am I dealing in reality? Or am I sort of screening out the bits that I don't like? It's not wrong, for example, to be angry. It's just dangerous.
So when you say the critical faculties, it seems that the person you're interacting with engaged critically, that actually receiving some genuine information.
Yes.
And then vice versa,
learning
something.
Yeah. So someone says something to me, or I say something to someone, and it doesn't just bounce off. It actually is taken in, received. I've never thought of that before. Let's discuss it. Could be like this, maybe it's like that. And you're having a genuine dialogue. But if you're just going from one set of feelings to another, you can be fairly sure you've been sentimentalized. Is that the one? I think I do. I keep going, and I'm getting it slowly.
Okay, so sometimes I think people can blame others.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
I'll change the slide. I think you're right. because it is important that we do say, it is me that's feeling the feeling. And it is my feeling, not your feeling. You make me feel angry. I own the feeling. I own the anger. Now, you may be right to make me feel angry. There's all sorts of things you might do, but it is my anger. Yeah, you're right. I'll change the slide. Thank you.
Sorry, just on that. Mm-hmm. That's got to be totally wrong. Because if you chop me with a sword, that's something you did to me, so I'll have
feeling.
Pain. Mm-hmm. And out of that, I might get angry. And that will definitely be because of what you did to me. And I think that whole thing about owning my emotions could possibly be something very much of this individual I thing, where I'm an island, I'm not going to be affected by you, and this whole emotion, whatever I'm feeling, it's mine and I can change it to be whatever I want.
No. I can't change it. It is there. And so you own the action, the provocation, and I own the anger. I may be happy for you to chop my leg off with your sword, but I own the happiness. It's unlikely, but, you know, stranger things have happened. But so I take responsibility for it. And I have to then do the responsible action, which may mean confronting you. In your case with the sword, it may mean restraining you. So I am the one who has to say, what is the appropriate action, moral response here? And it may be to run away. It may, you know, there's a whole range of responses that I might have. It may be to defend myself. It could be a lot of different things. But I have to sit down and say, what is that? And only in that sense. I don't get to choose my feelings. I may be able to influence them to some degree. A lot of the time we run away from them because they are frightening. And so the object is so powerful, we are afraid to confront the object. And then there's all sorts of other things we do with them to avoid the reality. Anything else?
Right at the beginning, when you were explaining those three categories, I said you didn't want to see one as necessarily better than the other, like historical version. But it seems like you're quite critical of our present moment, right? So are you saying that a healthy kind of relational emotion is what we should be going for, and almost like that should be historicized in itself? And I don't mean like big history, I mean small history, even within a relationship. Go through a tough time, then it gets sort of like personally historicized as opposed to the self-referential, non-historicized sentiment. Or is there no place for, I don't know, it just seems like we're very critical of our present moment because we have to be. How do you not see them?
I mean, I think the I-we has lots of positive things in it. And I think the IU has lots of positive things in it. What I'm encountering in the self-referential I is very destructive. So I don't have a whole lot of time for it because I have to spend a lot of time repairing it. But I do see a problem in both the IWE and the IU because in the IWE, as a consciousness, the we is stronger than the I, and then the person can't necessarily self-actualize. In any large community of people who are more conscious of themselves, of the community, difference is very hard to negotiate. But in the other context, in the I or the IU context, I can be as different as I like, and the more different the better, because there's no one to tell me who I am. I'm trying on all kinds of weirdness until I get some effect from somebody. But then I'm awfully lonely, and I don't know how to locate myself. And so you've got wonderful strengths in the IWE, and you've got terrible weaknesses in the IWE. And my solution as a Christian is I believe in the Trinity, which is an amazing combination of the one, the absolute intimate, the infinite intimate, and the three, which is our personal identity. So as I said here on Monday morning, the Father is not the Son. The Father is perfect, the Son is perfect, the difference is perfect. So my Son doesn't have to be a mirror image of me. He must be himself, and we can still be one. And that's one of the reasons I'm so profoundly impressed by Christianity, is it's the only religion that has actually negotiated that issue of difference. Unfortunately, most of the time, the church tends to just mirror the society around it. So at the moment, we have hopelessly individualistic church people who don't understand the Trinity in our churches in England and in the United States. I don't know what it's like here. Are you practicing Trinitarians, those of you who might be Christian? If you're not, you perhaps need to work out what that means. Yeah. To love someone unconditionally. I think you have to understand what that unconditional means. And it has to have a framework. It has to, you know, when we use the word love, for me, for many, many years, it was almost a useless word because I couldn't define the attributes of it. And if I started to, I would go and watch some film somewhere and it would be smothered by basically love is feeling attracted to someone and having sex with them. It's so strong in our society, the idea that attraction equals love, that it's a very hard piece of propaganda to resist. And so I had to really use other words until I began to re-establish what the categories and the attributes of love are. And what helped me to do that, some of you may find this really strange, was a study of the Old Testament law. Because I read in the New Testament, Jesus said that if you want to love someone, basically it's the same as fulfilling the law. So I thought, well, let me look at the law and see what it says. And it talks about don't murder, don't steal, don't commit adultery. It has a whole framework. And as I realized that the Old Testament law was actually a two-dimensional picture of a three-dimensional reality, and that in the New Testament the law was actually heavier and bigger, I began to see, oh, this is what love looks like. This is how I treat a person, every human being. And poof, that was enormous for me. And then I began to understand and be able to use the word love again because it had meaning. But it had been completely savaged by the propaganda of the society. And so now I can start to, when I say to my wife, you know, I love you, I'm actually saying something substantial. I'm also saying you're also lovely and you attract me with all these wonderful things. But this is the commitment I'm making to you. I will never leave you or forsake you, ever. I will do all I can to give you life and make your life full. I won't steal anything from you, not your dignity or your honor or anything. You are safe with me in that level. I won't covet any other person. I will be satisfied with you. And so on and so on. Those things are somehow, then she has infinite value because she's made in God's image. And so when I touch her, I'm touching God himself because he loves her. That's for me quite a strong motivation to stay in the game. Okay, well it's, okay, one more question because it's 5:52.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. It's just 1,000 times harder. And then the question is, how did you get in the relationship? Go into your relationships with your eyes open. Sometimes it's too late, and that's tragic. I want to say that carefully, because I'm not naive about how bad things can be. And if someone is violent and abusive and so on, we have the right to protect ourselves and to withdraw. Part of the process, perhaps, of helping them wake up from their narcissism. And I don't want to oversimplify in 2 or 3 minutes, or pretend if you just love someone, that all of that goes away. It doesn't. That is part of what it means to be staying in the game. But I may need to withdraw. And that might be part of the hard reality of love, too. Okay.
Marsh, maybe. Thank you.